traffic generator? Is it a beam width? so there's all kinds of complications to this that's not so straightforward. And even when we talk about polarization, polarization is really with respect to, you know, the ground plane of the antenna itself and the plane of the antenna itself. They'd be more accurate at that point. So there's a lot of confusion here. I'm not so sure that that we're putting forward a really nice, sophisticated model here, if you know what I'm saying.
K-E-Y.
Go ahead, Bill. And it's getting late, and my guess is you've got to get your beauty sleep. Over to you, Bill.
Roger, but okay. Funny, you guys are not mentioning anything. You're saying MUF and all. How about LUF? How come that's not mentioned, which is an integral part of this discussion, over?
My understanding of LUF is that as you go low enough in frequency for a particular time of the day, the ionosphere is reflecting like gangbusters, reflecting, which is really refraction. Let me use that word in quotes. The D layer starts absorbing. As you go to lower and lower frequency, the D layer absorbs. So lower usable frequency is the frequency where the, let me call it the dielectric constant, absorption. The absorption characteristics of the D layer starts dominating. I think that's what causes LUF, but I'm not an HF person, so I could be wrong. Back to you, Mel.
Okay. LUF is actually, there's a distinct cutoff line. Well, I shouldn't say distinct, but it does occur. LUF is normally found below 10 megahertz. So when you talk about 160 and 80 and 40, you're talking about the LUF. Now, MUF above 10 megahertz is basically, what is MUF? Well, it's the path, it's the time of day, it's the season, it's the location, it's the solar UV, it's the X-ray radiation, it's the levels of the ionosphere disturbances. This is what makes up MUF. So this is what you take into consideration when you're thinking about working, you know, a certain band or what, you know, what to expect. And this, I could say, is all based on looking above 10 megahertz, Dick. Below 10 megahertz, you look at basically LUF, over.
Yep. I remember my very first QSO on 80 meters at high noon. At 80 meters, 3.75 megacycles, roughly, novice band, talked to a guy a few miles away, just barely got through because of huge D-layer absorption at high noon at 80 meters. So I certainly was running into this. I'm going to step back one, two transmissions and go back to Glenn. Glenn, I'm sending a radio wave in the Z direction, and it's about to go at a grazing angle to the ionosphere, and it's going to be refracted. I have set up a vertical plane of observation, which is normal to the direction of propagation. So I got this plane, and I'm about to analyze my radio wave. I've stopped time, and I have created a wave. I'm using a certain number of watts on a dipole antenna at 80 meters, and I've created a certain number of volts per meter and amps per meter. I've got a given amount of H field and E field at my plane of observation at this instant of time. I first did that measurement at 80 meters. I then did the measurement at 6 meters, much higher in frequency. And I used the exact same antenna pattern, a dipole, at 6 meters, and I transmitted the exact same number of watts at that plane of observation. I have the exact same number of volts per meter and the same number of amps per meter. In that plane of observation, I have the exact same E field and H field, irrespective of frequency. Do you see what I'm saying, Glenn? KT2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, no, I do, Dick. I see where you're going with this, but I think where the confusion in this is coming in is that once it's hitting these different levels of atmosphere, that what's happening is that we're getting a certain amount of, you know, refraction, reflection, absorption in the different layers. And I think until you really look at the whole picture, like kind of like what Mel was saying, that, you know, putting it all together, there's a bunch of different effects going on here other than just the ionosphere. And with frequency, each, you know, wavelength and energy level is going to have, we know it has a different effect with different levels of atmosphere and how it, you know, goes through these different gases and plasma of atmosphere. And a certain amount of it is going to be reflective, some of it will be other, you know. But to sit down and just come up with one simple theory of how these waves are, you know, being affected by these different forms of atmosphere is a little hard to put my finger on right now. So I'm going to have to pass this back to you. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'm going to go one step deeper. I've got that plane of observation, and whether the frequency hitting it was 80 meters or 6 meters, in the plane of observation, the E field and the H field are the same, regardless of frequency. I've stopped time. So therefore, the wavelength that's being transmitted in that plane of observation, I don't see it. As I move forward with that plane, I go deeper into the Z direction, how far I have to move the plane before I go positive E field versus negative E field, yes, that is wavelength. And now that will be a shorter distance at 6 meters than it will be at 80 meters. Give you that. Now I'm going to hit you with a puzzle, but just to give an overall understanding here of an area that's often misunderstood. Let me drop. And whether the wave is 6 meters or 80 meters doesn't matter. I've got one of those frequencies. I've got the exact same watts per square meter being transmitted. I've got a known amount of E field. I've stopped time to analyze this wave in my thought experiment, and I'm sliding this plane of observation, which is normal to the z-axis, I'm sliding it deeper or closer in the z-axis. I slide it to the point where the E field is maximum. I've stopped time. The wave has stopped, and I'm analyzing it. I've slid the plane of observation until the E field is maximum. At that exact plane location in space, is the H field also maximum, or is the H field minimum? Over to you, Glenn.
Okay, let me try to, the way I'm trying to visualize this right now is that you have an antenna in space, you've stopped time, and you're looking at E and H at that particular time as an electromagnetic wave. So at that point, I would say that both are at maximum.
Yeah, the antenna doesn't have to be in space. It doesn't matter where the antenna is. Give that man a cigar. You've got it right. You'd be amazed how many people got that backwards. So as I slide that plane of observation, which is normal to the z-axis of this far-field electromagnetic wave, and I slide it until the E is maximum, at that exact same location, the H is maximum. I now slide the plane of observation a little bit further forward, and I find the first E field null. I find the next E field null. The H field is also nulled there at that exact same location. I continue sliding this plane of observation, and I find the next maximum, which is opposite in polarity. The E field is equally as strong, but opposite in polarity. The H field is equally as strong, but opposite in polarity. So each one of these places where I get a peak of energy on my plane of observation, I could call that a packet of energy. This E and this H, and E crossed H is a significant number of watts. I could call it watts per square meter. I could call it power flux density. Give it all the fancy words I like. Let me drop. I slide a little bit further forward. I find a null where E and H are both gone. I slide a little bit further in Z. I find another peak of E and H where they're both in opposite polarity, the exact same E crossed H, the exact same amount of watts per square meter, pointing vector, call it what you like. So I've got these individual packets of energy traveling in the Z direction in space when I allow time to flow again. The only thing that differs when I go to a different frequency is how far I have to slide that plane before I find the next null and the next peak. That's where wavelength is, but the wavelength, we all picture in our mind that the wavelength has got something, it's got a certain amount of width to it as we transmit it, because we picture that wave coming out of our antenna, whether it be a Yagi or a dipole, which has a certain width to the elements of that antenna, and we picture that as a wavelength. And we picture it as a something that's a, you know, that goes left and right as a dimension of something about that wave. That's not where the wavelength is. The wavelength is only in the Z direction. And now I'm having more trouble picturing this wave fitting in between the molecules, if you know what I mean. At that plane of observation, at that instant of time, I've got a finite amount of E, I've got a finite amount of H, which I can quantify, and it doesn't have a wavelength. That plane of observation, I could make, if the signal that was transmitted from the antenna was enough miles away, that plane of observation could be 10 miles wide and 10 miles high, and anywhere in that plane, I'll get the exact same E field and the exact same H field at that distance from the transmitting antenna. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting point, Dick, and I think where a lot of this, you know, becomes kind of interesting is, I know I've seen these curves before. I'm not sure I know the name of them, but I'm going to look for them and look them up at one time because I know what I'm looking for, but I'm going to describe this to you. Basically, there's a group of curves that represent gases of different materials, and oxygen being one of them, and their effects on electromagnetic wave energy, and how much, and the curves are represented in, you know, reflected and absorbed energy of electromagnetic waves. And I've seen these curves before, and I'm sure that this has a big impact on it, is that when, through different gases, what is the absorption and reflection rates of the different gases at different points of the atmosphere? And I think if I can get those curves and we'll take a peek at them, we can probably get a lot better understanding of really what's going on with real propagation closer to the molecular level. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, my latest philosophy for the last couple of years is to try to understand it at the molecular level. Because if you zoom back to the macroscopic level, I'm losing it. You can have the fanciest equation in the world on the piece of paper. People can manipulate it till the cows come home. They can come up with all kinds of crazy answers. And they make they dive into the assumption that the equation is perfect. And they completely forget about the fact that every one of those equations is an approximation. It is a mental model by some particular author of that equation. And that equation fits most of the data he was able to measure at that point in his life, and he came up with that particular model. Every one of these models is flawed. They all work to some degree. So I'm a little worried about people saying, you know, the equation says such and such, therefore it's obvious and this is the answer. That's some of the answer. Wesley, you're driving us mad. We don't really know. Well, I'm slowly finding out an awful lot about what I know that I don't know. And we've got a long way to go. We're struggling.
Hey, Dick, one more quick comment.
And I have one as well.
Yeah, I'm getting ready to quit because I've got to go to work tomorrow. But Glenn and then Wesley and I don't want to. Go ahead, Glenn.
Just interestingly enough, though, Dick, I agree with you in a lot of it. That's why most of the time when we talk about these science things, I'm usually the first person who says, hey, you got to remember these are models, and models are constantly changing. But if there's one group of models that have been around quite some time now, and we're getting near the 100-year mark on them, is like Planck's constant and the quantum models. And these have been mathematically holding together for quite some time. And granted, they've been used and expanded upon, but many times when we go back to these models, they really do answer a lot, and there's a lot, you know, there are things that I think a lot of people really should look at a lot closer, and they do affect us here as ham radio operators in terms of propagation and what our radio waves are really doing. You know, where is that energy? What does it affect on the masses that it impacts and how it really works? How does it affect our atmosphere and our antennas? So it is all good stuff, Dick. I'm going to pass it back to you. And it's a shame I couldn't meet you today at the over at HRU, but one of these days, Dick. So let me bid you farewell. Have a good evening. K2RIW, KC2QIQ. Always a pleasure, Dick.
Yeah, I combed my hair today because I knew I was going to meet Glenn. That was a joke. Go ahead, Wesley.
Well, I do love you guys. You're the guys who are actually giving me a lot of help. And nobody, if I say, oh, you're wrong, oh, I disagree, whatever. It's only the standpoint. It's not what I think. I do really appreciate your help. But what I assume from today is either I was not able to express myself, but I didn't get the answer to one particular question. What mechanism, what tools, what actually makes the pure energy creating mechanical, thermal reaction in the mass? Dark mass get hot. Whatever that you weren't able to answer, or at least I never heard the answer of it. But anyhow, thank you very much, guys. And to exit.
I'm going to give you one piece of theory. This is a pretty speculative thing that I've been troubled with. How does a microwave oven heat up the water molecules that are in my food? I know that the water molecule is a dipole molecule. I know that radio energy at any frequency, that just happens to be 2450 megacycles, because that was a frequency left over, and they set up microwave ovens at that frequency. Nothing magic about it. But I pour a significant amount of energy at 2450 megacycles into my microwave oven, and I know that those dipole molecules of water try to follow the flipping back and forth of that E field at 2450 megacycles. And I know that they do it with a lag. They don't quite keep up. And that hysteresis loop represents energy loss. That's the beginning of an understanding. Let me drop. So you got these water molecules flipping back and forth, trying to follow the E fields of the 2450 megacycle wave. They don't quite keep up. And I know that they absorb energy and they get hot. The word heat, temperature, is average kinetic energy. So those water molecules with higher average kinetic energy, higher temperature, must be moving faster. What did they push against? Who made them move faster? Just because I'm wiggling them back and forth? Okay, here's my next level of understanding. Air molecules, for instance, in the room with you right now are moving 500 meters per second. The mean free path between them is 63 nanometers. Every time one of those air molecules moves 63 nanometers, he strikes another air molecule. He has no choice. And the word strike, by the way, is a very beautiful bounce, which has got no loss of energy. I won't go there. So every 63 nanometers of motion at 500 meters per second, he's striking another air molecule. So the rate at which he's striking another air molecules is a huge number. It's in the terahertz. He's striking them real fast. A lot of bouncing is going on. So the water molecules are doing something similar. The water molecules are striking each other. They've got a temperature. They're moving. They're in a fluid. And as these dipole molecules wiggle back and forth, picture it as a potato-shaped object wiggling back and forth. One end is positive, one end is negative of this water molecule, and it's twisting back and forth with that E field. But the individual water molecules are striking each other. Let me drop. At the instant potato number one strikes potato number two, and potato number one and potato number two are both rotating, trying to follow that E field, the rotational velocity of the striking molecules impart extra energy when they bounce. I can see if the center of one potato struck the other center of the other potato, they just bounce apart. Same energy going in as coming out. But if they're both a potato-shaped object in the process of rotating at the instant of impact, I can see a mechanism by which, after the bounce, they are moving faster than they were before. Simplistic model. I'm trying to use it as to explain at the molecular level why does water in a microwave oven get hot. I know it's got to move faster. What are they pushing against to move faster? They're pushing against each other. These rotating potatoes hit each other, end up with greater velocity after the bounce. I don't know if that works, but I'm trying it. K2RIW listening.
Very interesting. Glenn, can you take a stand for it, or Eric?
Well, I agree with Dick, you know, wholeheartedly on this one, and he's really onto something here. And the, I guess the other difference too is that keep in mind that every particle or every atom that's out there has, you know, a different atomic number, different count of protons and electrons. And when electromagnetic waves, you know, affect their valence shells, it's going to basically cause that whole, you know, material to react differently. And each, you know, different material or gas or whatever it is that it's that this energy is encountering, you're going to get different effects. And it's mainly due to its atomic count. In other words, every element has got an atomic count to it. And when an electromagnetic wave affects the valence shell, then, you know, creates ionization, polarization, causes the molecule to move in space, and sometimes it causes friction, sometimes it causes reflection. You know, there's all different effects, so each material is going to have a different response to this. And, you know, that's all part of it. And you kind of have to look at these effects on the different materials and see what you come up with. Over to you, Wesley, KC2QIQ.
Hold on now. Assuming I'm using my microwave oven in the normal manner and no arcing is taking place, there is no ionization taking place inside that microwave oven. It is pure.
That's the material, Dick.
I'm talking about water molecules. No ionization. That
oxygen.
The outer shell of those water molecules was not excited to a higher state. No ionization take place. No electrons were ripped off of any of those water molecules. They're at a higher temperature. They did not get ionized. And
absorption.
They did not get ionized to a... They did not get excited. The outer shell did not get excited to a higher energy level and then drop down and give off a characteristic wavelength. The water molecules did not do that in your microwave oven.
Yeah, but they did get raised to a higher energy level, but still remained balanced. Just because they didn't become dipolar and became absorptive doesn't mean that they didn't absorb the energy, and that was directly affected by the valence shell on those on that molecule of H2O.
I strongly disagree. Not one of those water molecules got excited to a higher level. They got extra energy. They went to a higher temperature. Each individual water molecule has a greater amount of kinetic energy now. They're moving faster. Each individual outer shell of each water molecule did not get excited to a higher level. No degree of excitation of the individual orbits of the individual electrons changed.
Contraire.
Okay. If they went to a higher level, they are by definition, at some rate, dropping back down. What wavelength are they emitting when they drop back down?
Thermal energy, heat. As a matter of fact, you can determine energy level and by just the temperature. As a matter of fact, you can determine wavelengths by temperature. They're direct equations directly to temperature. Temperature noise and energy level. Absolutely. Those molecules that are heated have absorbed energy and are emitting heat.
When I heat up a 50 ohm resistor and I get more radio energy out of it, where's the radio energy coming from, Glenn?
The voltages and the currents that have been fed through it.
The voltage and currents fed through it created the heating. The heating creates black body radiation. I can measure the Planck's constant noise coming out of that 50 ohm resistor directly proportional to its temperature. I didn't excite those individual carbon molecules of that resistor to higher level. I simply made them move faster. That's what temperature is. I raised their temperature. The individual molecules, which have a shell of electrons around them, are wiggling in space. Those molecules, it's a solid material. They're locked into a matrix. They're locked in position. It's not a fluid. But they're shaking back and forth more violently, physically moving more violently. That's what temperature is. And the cloud of electrons that follow the motion is a kind of radio noise. That's not excitation of ionization to a higher energy level. It's simply greater kinetic energy called temperature. Over to you, Glenn.
I agree with you halfway. It's not ionization that's that energy. It is thermal energy. I'm agreeing with you there. But where I think we have a little disconnect here between your and my understanding on this is that if you look at the orbits of those electrons in the valence shell, they may not be dissimilar, but the orbit level is higher, i.e. the energy is higher, i.e. that's why the noise is there. So there's noise, there's thermal temperature that you've actually raised. The energy that's in that resistor now is at a higher level than when it was before that electricity went through it. That power, that kinetic energy, was converted into heat. That heat excited those atoms inside there, and those valence shells are at higher levels. They're definitely, those electrons, the count is the same, so they're not ionized, but they're at higher orbits.
I strongly disagree. If they're at higher orbits, they must periodically drop back down. When they drop back down, they must emit a very characteristic wavelength. In the microwave oven, they are not doing that. In that 50 ohm resistor you're heating, they are not doing that. Those electrons did not get excited to a higher shell. I strongly believe that. You're going to have to show me a lot of evidence otherwise, Glenn.
Well, if we use thermal scans and we're looking at that electromagnetic energy coming off of that resistor, that's an electromagnetic wave that you can night vision glasses. I mean, that's how you see heat, right?
Okay. It has a Rayleigh-Jeans curve of energy versus wavelength. It's a very smooth curve. It does not have individual characteristic wavelengths of electron shells being excited to a higher orbit and dropping back down. That's not what thermal energy is. You're talking about something different. The characteristic wavelength I get out of solar energy is because that solar material is ionized. Those electrons are excited to higher levels and being yanked off of those molecules and dropping back down and giving out very characteristic wavelengths, telling me that that was iron going from level 3 to level 2, and that was helium going from level 3 to level 2, and so on. You get very characteristic wavelengths. Your microwave oven and your 50 ohm resistor does not do that. Over to you, Glenn.
Here again, we agree, but I disagree with something here. Yes, I agree with you that that you're getting a non-ionized energy increase associated to temperature, but that temperature also has a wavelength, and that wavelength is visible, and that's associated to orbital altitude, or you know, it's how higher energy that valence shell has been raised to, but not ionized.
If temperature is defined as average kinetic energy of a molecule, and if average kinetic energy of a molecule, which is constant in mass, can have more kinetic energy is on average it has more velocity. Let me call it more speed. It's got more speed on average. I don't have to change the electron orbits at all. If I move them faster, they've got higher temperature. If I gently heat up a material, I'm not exciting those molecules to a higher shell, those electrons to a higher shell. I'm simply moving the molecules faster. That's what I believe temperature is. Ionization is not required in order to raise the temperature. Every time I cook an egg, I'm not ionizing it. Over to you, Glenn.
That is correct, actually. What you're actually doing is there is a friction involved. So I agree with Dickens' area.
You and I are going to have to dig a little deeper into this one, Glenn.
Well, here again, as I said, as far as I understand, granted it's been a while since I've taken a course in this one and I've looked at it that closely, but my understanding is that when you take and an object is heating, the energy, okay, that's being increased in that is orbital. In other words, and it's usually valence orbital, but not ionized. In other words, the difference between ionized energy, and from what I understand, is that you're kicking off basically electrons at that particular point so that the atomic count is different. That's a different type of energy, ionization. When the atomic count is balanced, but the orbit level is increased, that's an increase in energy associated to, you know, its radial orbit, and the temperature is increased. I mean, I'll look at the equation again, but I'm quite sure that that's what it is, Dick.
But in the example that was described by Dick, there was no way of ionization to be happened.
I'm not talking about ionization. I'm talking about orbital height versus energy in a molecule.
Let's call that excited to a higher level of orbital energy of those electrons. And if you're exciting them to a higher level, they have a strong influence to drop back down. When they drop down, by quantum mathematics, they give off an extremely characteristic wavelength. Your water molecules in that microwave oven do not give off a characteristic wavelength. Over to you, Glenn.
Here again, I think we're talking about apples and oranges again. But the characteristic wavelength that you're talking about is ionization. And what I'm saying is that I'm not talking about ionization. I'm talking about thermal energy. And thermal energy at the molecular level, okay, the atomic count is the same. In other words, nothing has changed. There are no exchanges in ionization level. In other words, there's no charge being created. So take charge out of the equation here in a heated material. But what is happening is that the orbital valence shell is at a higher level. So in other words, it's just at a higher orbit, i.e. higher energy. That's the absorption rate of a molecule. In other words, as it's absorbing energy, how it absorbs the energy is the altitude of those orbital shells is increased. And that's why you're getting bombardment and friction, because the orbits are higher and they're rubbing into each other, creating the heat.
Interesting.
I don't agree.
What's moving then? The proton can't move. The neutron can't move. It's only the electrons that can move. You don't think that the carbon itself is shaking back and forth, do you, inside?
Absolutely. First of all, if they go to a higher orbital level, do they stay there forever, Glenn?
My understanding about temperature is that if you have an elevated temperature, they will stay at that level provided that there's no difference in equilibrium. So in other words, if the outside environment is at that temperature, they will stay at that orbit level unless, of course, they reach a different level of equilibrium. In other words, something else brings it back down again. So you'd have to have another difference. So in other words, a cooling effect. And then that would bring them to a lower level again at that time. Because the energy, once it's in motion, it stays there until you do something different, because the energy at that point is stored. So in other words, when you raise something in temperature, it will stay at that temperature until you do something to bring it back down again, like cool it, or put it in a room that's at a different temperature, like 25 degrees C, to bring it back down.
It was actually during Newtonian law that we were subjected, Glenn.
If I take any material that you have heated, Glenn, and I now cool it, it's got thermal emission. That's that very broad curve. We're not talking about that. If I cool your material, and if you think that heating is higher orbital level of the electrons, and cooling means that it's going to come back down, each one that jumps in a quantum manner, a very specific orbital altitude, there's very specific altitudes that we're allowed to have, eigenvalues, and nothing in between. So if I'm cooling your material, they're jumping back down in your model. When they jump back down, they give off a very characteristic sharp wavelength. If I cool the gas, if I cool the water in your microwave oven, if I cool the coffee in your cup, you're telling me I can measure very specific wavelengths coming out of it, very sharp wavelengths during the time you're cooling it? I don't think you can do that experiment, Glenn.
Here again, I think we're confusing something here. In other words, you're talking about ionization versus temperature. In other words, they're two different things. In other words, energy is being used to create delta T. Once it's at a temperature and it's at an equilibrium, if nothing around it is changing, it will stay there. Unless, of course, there's something to cool it back down again, or and it will come back down to that equilibrium level. But there's nothing jumping in that case. In other words, but the orbits themselves are at higher altitudes with respect to their geometry from the proton, neutron, which are in one area, as opposed to electrons. They're at higher levels, energy level states. But they're not jumping. In other words, jumping is requiring polarization change and ionization. That's completely different.
I got a question for you. I got two containers side by side, each exactly 1 liter. I've got pure oxygen, O2, in each one of them. The left-hand container, the oxygen molecules are at 25 degrees centigrade. The right-hand container, the oxygen O2 molecules are at 50 degrees centigrade. Tell me what's different about the O2 molecules in the right-hand container versus the left-hand container.
The oxygen that's inside the 50 degrees, in other words, let's say if we have two chambers, right, where at different equilibriums. So in other words, one is in a 25 degree C chamber, and the other one's in, let's say, a 60 degree C chamber, or 50 degrees, whatever. And they're at equilibrium. And if you were to look that there are pressure differences between those two, is the atomic count and everything within the same, the two containers the same? Yes, they are. But one will have a higher pressure. One will be at a higher energy level because PVNRT and the energy level inside that will be higher. There will be a higher pressure.
We're getting closer. Let me make the experiment one step more complicated. 1 liter volume on the left-hand side, 1 liter volume on the right-hand side. All the O2 molecules on the left-hand side are at 25 degrees C. The temperature, the average temperature of all the air molecules in the left-hand molecule, left-hand chamber, is 25 degrees C. The right-hand chamber, as I heated it up, the air molecules increased in pressure, PV equals NRT. I let the excess pressure out. There's a very small little hole on each one of these chambers. Both of them are exactly at room pressure. The O2 molecules in the left-hand chamber are at 25 degrees C. The O2 molecules in the right-hand chamber are at 50 degrees C because I heated them and I'm keeping them there. I've got a temperature-controlled oven on the outside of the right-hand liter chamber, but I did not allow the pressure to increase. So both pressures are the same, but a good thermometer on the left-hand chamber reads 25, a good thermometer in the right-hand chamber reads 50 degrees C. Tell me what's different about the O2 molecules in the right-hand chamber.
Maxwell Cage.
I'm losing you here, Dick, on something. Because as at one point you're talking about something's opening, escaping, and then we're talking about enclosures. You have to say that one more time because I'm missing the point.
My whole living room, my whole kitchen has got nothing but oxygen in it, in my example, and I'm in a spacesuit. I've got two ovens. The left-hand oven, I've set the temperature dial at 25 degrees C. It didn't have to turn on because the whole damn room is at 25 degrees C. The right-hand oven is at 50 degrees C because I've turned on the oven controls. But the oven itself is not a sealed item. The air pressure in the left-hand oven and the right-hand oven is identical. It's room pressure. My thermometer in the left-hand oven reads 25. My thermometer in the right-hand oven reads 50 degrees C. Tell me what's different about the O2 molecules in the right-hand oven.
There's a difference in density between the two. In other words, obviously the one at higher temperature has lower density than the one at room temperature.
I accept that. What is the thermometer measuring?
Temperature.
What is temperature?
Patient.
Glenn, what is temperature? What is the thermometer measuring?
Kinetic energy.
I want Glenn to say it.
Yeah, well, yes, it is. It is energy.
What kind of energy? The 50 degrees centigrade reading temperature in the right-hand oven is telling you something about those O2 molecules. What is it telling you?
See, I'm losing you here again. I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Temperature is average kinetic energy. Kinetic energy. The air molecules in the room with you right now are moving at 500 meters per second. If I heat up your room to a higher temperature, they move with an average speed greater than 500 meters per second. Kinetic energy is velocity of the molecules. I don't think you and I seem to be in agreement on that one. Over to you, Glenn.
No, we are, Dick. We're in agreement on that. I just guess where the difference is in the model that we're describing of the molecule itself. In other words, what you were saying before is that the proton is what's moving. And what I'm talking about is displacement and average altitude of a valence shell, okay, in a molecule to determine what its energy level is. I think that's the area that we're different. In other words, obviously, because I've been saying all along that the temperature is at a higher energy state, and it's at that level, and its altitude is higher. You're saying it's not. That's our disagreement.
Each of those O2 molecules in that right-hand oven, the 50-degree oven, the whole damn molecule, its nucleus plus its nuclear plus its electron cloud, has an average velocity that's greater. These are individual objects that are a little bit more than 3.5 nanometers apart, and each one of them is only an angstrom in radius. So there's a great big space in between each one of them. Each individual O2 molecule is moving with a higher speed in the right-hand oven. That's what the thermometer is measuring. Average kinetic energy of the whole damn molecule moving. The individual electrons of the hotter O2 molecules are not at a higher orbit in my mind. I'm convinced because that is a degree of ionization. You haven't ionized them. They are not more conductive. They are not a plasma. You partially ionize something. You raise the electrons to a higher orbit. It is a kind of ionization. And when they drop back down, they're going to give off a characteristic wavelength. The O2 molecules in the right-hand oven, when I cool them back down, do not do that. Those molecules have the exact same radius as the 25 degree C ones. But the 50 degree C molecules have, as a total entity molecule, they are moving with a higher velocity. That's what temperature is, I believe. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, I kind of understand what you're describing, but I don't really agree with it. I think what's really happening is that when you're looking at the expansion of a molecule and its displacement, is that what you're looking at is the volume of the molecule itself is expanding in a gas to a larger area, mainly because its overall average area, because of its orbits are larger, pushing it apart. It's actually expanding. But is the nucleus itself moving protons and neutrons against the other protons and neutrons as an interreaction in balance? I don't believe that to be true. I'll double check on some of this again, but you know, it's been a while since I've looked at some of these models, but I don't believe that it's actually the neutrons that actually and protons that actually collide in their count. It's really the electrons are really the motivators that really do all of the work or interaction with energy. So in other words, the nucleus and the protons are generally always locked in balance. Now, do they actually move to temperature with respect to each other? I'm not so sure, other than just volumetrically because of the orbit value that changes between one molecule to the one next to it, if they're all of like type.
I don't agree, and I'm going to give you another example. Let me go back to PV equals NRT, very well respected. 500 meters per second, air molecules, 63 nanometers, mean distance, mean reaction distance, you know what I mean. They're going to strike each other every 63 nanometers on average. Tremendous spaces are between each air molecule, perfect vacuum spaces between each individual air molecule. They're bouncing against each other like crazy. They're bouncing against the walls, and you and I call that pressure. When I had sealed chamber and I heated up, PV equals NRT tells me again, higher pressure. What does higher pressure mean? That because the temperature is higher, the molecules have a higher velocity. The whole damn molecule of the exact same diameter of molecule is moving faster. That means when it strikes the wall, it hits the wall with a higher velocity. You call that greater pressure. The pressure that you sense on PV equals NRT is a beautiful example of higher velocity. The thermometer tells you, the pressure gauge tells you. You don't have to change the diameter of the molecule. You don't have to raise the electrons to a higher orbit. The whole damn molecule as a unit, its nucleus, its protons, its neutrons, and its electron cloud stays the exact same diameter. They move faster. They hit each other more often. They hit the walls with greater velocity. You and I call that pressure. That's what I believe. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have an electron microscope to really look in there to really see if protons are hitting each other, although I really don't think that they do. And the only reason why I kind of suggest that they aren't is in other words, they are expanding apart. In other words, they do want to move apart as the orbital levels increase, but they're not. But I think that just the description of the model, because when I look at, let's say, in a model, and I want to look at an orbit increasing its temperature, I can actually look at an elevation of orbit and determine the energy in a quantum. You know, here again, you're trying to make a point, and I'm getting a little lost. In other words, when I'm looking at things, I'm looking at, you know, what a basic model is of, you know, of what an atom is, you know, and it's got a proton, it's got a neutron, which its atomic count is kind of sealed, and the electrons are kind of like the motivators. They're the guys that do all the work. And, you know, expanding with temperature just basically moves that the displacement or the spacing between the protons is increasing. But why is the spacing increasing between the protons? Because the orbital levels are higher and pushing them apart, thus increasing, you know, the temperature. But in other words, when you're saying that when I look at a whole atom, let's say, and if I were going to say that the whole atom was moving violently that would kind of suggest that the neutron and the protons are moving in equal and opposite directions with respect to each other in a like a random type of energized fashion. And I'm saying that, you know, the mathematical model that I'm familiar with kind of suggests that the that what's happening is the orbital level is increasing and they're moving apart, but and being pushed apart because of the amount of energy in them, and because the orbits are so much higher, they're being like into a large displacement. They need more area, or if they're in a, you know, in a closed environment, they're being pressurized in that area. But that's just, keep in mind that this is my understanding of it. None of the models that I've seen talk about a movement of the proton and the neutron where the atoms are actually banging into each other. It's mostly an electron environment that I'm familiar with when I talk about, you know, energy states. KTOR-IW, KC2-QIQ.
Welcome to...
Hey, you know, if it were to jump orbital levels, it would actually emit, it'll emit more spectra. It don't jump orbital levels on temperature, if that's what you're talking about. You know, it's quantum mechanics. It's different. It's a whole different game.
No, you're right, Eric. No, that was the point that I made earlier about ionization. They're not jumping. In other words, when you have something that moves from one orbital level to the next orbital level, okay, what I'm talking about is displacement of orbits. In other words, the orbit is actually just takes up more area. It's in a larger orbit. It's taking a longer time to swing around that around the nucleus.
I think it would be better served if you consider it to be vibration, which actually goes along with the later version of string theory. Think of it as a vibrating drum. The higher the temperature, the faster it vibrates.
Glenn, you're saying the electrons do all the work. When it comes to atoms being combined and the electrons of the outer shell interact with each other when you make a compound, I'm in agreement. But now I've got this compound of two oxygen atoms. You and I call it O2. This compound thing has an average velocity in your room right now, average speed of 500 meters per second. Tell me what is moving 500 meters per second. I say the whole darn pair of oxygen atoms, which is called a compound called O2, that total thing, two nucleuses, two shells coupled together, the whole damn thing moves 500 meters per second average speed. I'm not changing the rate at which the electrons move. I'm not changing the rate at which the protons and neutrons do whatever they do. I'm not changing anything internal to the O2 compound molecule. I'm not changing anything about the individual oxygen atoms. The compound of O2, I'm moving the whole damn thing 500 meters per second. That is the average temperature of those O2 molecules in the room with you right now. Does that make any sense? KQLAW.
By the way, they're ionically bonded.
And that's correct. You're both correct on this one, and I'm in total agreement. I guess it's just my understanding of the model. In other words, from the mathematical point of view, is you're right. Nuclear level is not changed. So in other words, what we have here is we have, you know, inside the individual nuclei in a compound or in a specific molecule at this particular time, that what's happening is because they're in balance, that when you look at the electron and the orbits themselves, there's no jumping, so there's no ionization, but what's happening is they're expanding and they're moving apart. Now, are they, you know, moving against each other in terms of like a violent reaction, or are they being displaced and pushed apart? Here again, my understanding is that they're being pushed apart. You're saying that they're kind of like vibrating back and forth, and I'm not sure that I understand that model, but I do understand them kind of like pressing against each other and pushing away because of the orbital shell on the outside being at a higher altitude. That is my understanding, Dick, and as I said, it's not that I'm, you know, that I'm saying I'm right or anything. I'm just saying that's the way that I understand it. And, you know, it also makes sense to the mathematical model, because when I'm looking at the energy level, and it always comes back to radius, and the radius is obviously longer in a quantum model when you're talking about higher temperature. So as T increases, R is longer. So, you know, and this is not ionization, so, but it, that is my understanding of it, though, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I say absolutely not. Absolutely not. First of all, when we talk about the vibrating in space, we're talking about a solid. I wanted to make it simpler. I went to a gas. O2 is a gas. Those molecules are completely free to move any way they want to.
Take it to absolute zero.
Well, Glenn feels that the excess pressure is because they're pushing against each other. They can't push against each other, Glenn. There's great big spaces between them. The average space between them versus the diameter of each one is a 30-to-1 ratio. They touch each other in the process of moving and colliding. You sense the pressure because they collide. The total molecule, O2 molecule, strikes the wall with a higher velocity at a higher temperature. When I take a given volume, if I take one mole of O2 and I put it in a fixed chamber at 25 degrees C, and then I heat up the chamber to 50 degrees C, the total number of molecules in the chamber did not change. The average spacing between the molecules did not change. The higher temperature means each individual molecule has more kinetic energy. More kinetic energy means that the total molecule, without changing the molecule in any way, is moving faster. They're striking against each other faster, they're striking the wall with higher velocity, and you sense that as a greater pressure. In order for each individual molecule to go to a larger diameter, you'd have to be expanding the electron cloud. To expand the electron cloud, the quantum mathematics won't let you do that. They have very specific radiuses they're allowed to be, and nothing else. It's quantized. It's eigenvalues. When you make them go slightly larger in diameter, they're hopping to a higher energy level of excitation, and that's a kind of partial ionization, in which case they'd have to be dropping back down and giving off a very characteristic wavelength. They don't do that.
Niels Bohr explains that quantum state.
Quantum state ain't changing. I'm not changing the diameter, one iota, of each individual O2 molecule. When I heat them up, they move faster as individual entities. Tremendous spaces in between. They're free to move. Each one moves 63 nanometers before they strike another one. Mean free path, mean free distance, 63 nanometers. They're only an angstrom in diameter. They're not pushing against each other by blowing up like a balloon. Your model makes them, each one expands like a balloon, push against each other, and you say that's the extra pressure. I strongly disagree. The extra pressure is the greater velocity at which they strike the wall. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW. We are friendly, by the way.
Yeah, no, I understand where you're coming from, and it still follows all the same rules. But in other words, what I'm thinking here is that because of the model itself, that the electrons themselves are the ones doing all the work here. In other words, they're the ones that are actually interfering with each other. It's like one electron from one compound or to the next molecule next to it are interfering with each other, because that's where the energy is coming in. It's the electron count itself. So when you're looking at the energy state in the quantum model, it's the electrons themselves that are actually absorbing or transferring all of this energy from one molecule to the next. So as the temperature is going up, it's the electrons themselves that are creating the interference. And that's where, you know, the energy is located, is in that area. But, you know, is it actually that the temperature is causing the whole, you know, nucleus to move back and forth against the other nucleus? I just don't see where that motion comes into the model anywhere. You know, that's where I'm having the problem, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Question?
In in the case of a solid piece of copper, like a piece of wire, the outer electrons and outer shells of copper atoms are free to move when the electrons hop from one copper molecule.